doesn't matter. Anyway, welcome to this LSE Ideas Alumni Network seminar. We've been talking about many things at our alumni group. This is the alumni of our Diplomacy and Strategy course, of course. And welcome back to many of our former members of that group. And welcome to many, many other people I recognise around the table. So very nice to have you all here. And I'm very delighted to have four speakers. I'm going to manage this with Bolshevik iron discipline, by the way. I've said to everybody 6-7 minutes maximum, because I want to then maximise the Q&A session. I'm judging by A, the topic, and B, the people around the table. There's going to be quite a lot of contributions. I'm actually going to go in the order, which is down there. Gideon, you'll set us on fire. Steve Erlanger from the New York Times will then put you out. Tim Oliver will introduce some economic balance. And Cherry, our good friend from China Foresight, will give us what we might call the Chinese perspective. I've given nobody any instructions other than to speak for 6 to 7 minutes maximum on the topic this morning, which I don't think needs much introduction: Brexit, Britain at the crossroads, European consequences, geopolitical risks, question mark. Gideon, why don't you kick us off? Thank you very much for being here. Gideon, over to you.
Okay. Thanks, Mick. And what will geopolitical consequences be? I guess the first most obvious point is that it will weaken the EU as an international actor and turn it into a much more kind of introspective organisation consumed by a crisis provoked by one of its major members leaving. However, weakening the EU as an actor, I mean, it's not much of an actor already. The European Union has been important in the sanctions on Russia, and there have been, I gather, something like 30 EU missions. Robert Cooper would know much more about those than me, but they tend to be quite low profile, but, you know, in places like Mali and so on. However, on a huge issue like Syria, for example, I mean, Steve and Robert and I were all at a Foreign Office kind of seminar with a lot of Americans late last week. One of the things that struck me in retrospect was that a lot of discussion about how to fix Syria was the complete absence of either the EU or as the Europeans, indeed, as significant actors in this debate. It was all about what the Russians were up to, what the US was up to, what the Syrians themselves, but also the Turks and the Saudis. Europe, which is obviously being completely destabilized by the backwash of this conflict, does not appear to be at all important in the discussion. So it's if anything, that situation will get worse, I think, if Britain leaves, because the British, at least by repute, are serious diplomatic players and so on, but will be consumed by really trying to sort out the relationship with Europe. I think the other thing that will happen is that, without wishing to be melodramatic about it, but I think the survival of the EU itself will come into question, because we can see that all the main EU countries, with the possible exception of Germany, but even they have the AfD now, you've got strong Eurosceptic parties which will look to whether Britain can make a success of leaving. And if it does, then I think you'll get other countries beginning to think about leaving. Talking to German diplomats, they're worried, for example, quite unexpectedly to me, about the Netherlands, where the Freedom Party is doing quite well, and where there's a strongly kind of Eurosceptic British-style debate going on, which is quite striking given that the Netherlands was one of the 6 founder members. But there would be others there. Scandinavia, I think, is also somewhere to look at. France, obviously, with Marine Le Pen, who is even threatening to come and campaign for Brexit within the UK, much to the embarrassment of the Leave campaign. So that, in turn, the fact that the EU survival would be in question, or it's at least in its current form, would, I think, ensure that it would be an antagonistic relationship between Britain and the EU. Because I think the EU has to see a UK, in its own interests, the UK's Brexit has to fail. We have to be seen to fail, because if we succeed, that's not good news for the European Union. It has to be shown that it's better to be in than out. Now, how would that be demonstrated? Again, the German diplomats I was talking to said that they would prefer it if the markets did the job for them. In other words, there was some sort of catastrophic collapse in the stock market and the pound, etc. However, the French are prepared to be a bit more proactive if the markets don't do the job for them. And I think at that point, the UK, whose first reaction would be, okay, you know, we've really got to try and make this work and make this as amicable a divorce as possible. If it began to feel that actually the EU was really out to get us, to put it in sort of blunt terms, it would then become in Britain's interest to start trying to actually weaken the EU, or at least find allies within it. And also they would start thinking, okay, you know, the foreign policy establishment would say, well, this was not a situation we ever wanted, but now we're in it. Let's actually see if there's some advantages that we can do with this situation that might work for us. And it was interesting talking to the Irish. I was in Dublin a couple of weeks ago. And although they're very opposed to Brexit, they think it would be bad for Britain, bad for Ireland, there's a sort of second fear at the back of their minds that a Britain that leaves the EU might begin to play the Irish game, but sort of double down on it, very low taxes, kind of go for an offshore strategy, because that would be the only thing that was open to us. But if we did that and began to play a sort of diplomatic game in which we sort of pick off members of the EU as, you know, friends, the people who might support us within the EU, then I think this amicable start to the sort of effort to sort it out might deteriorate into something really quite acrimonious. Looking more broadly, how long have I got? A couple of minutes. I think beyond the borders of the EU, obviously Russia would be emboldened. Now, the Russians are in a pretty... they're in a strange situation. Economically, I think they are in deep trouble. Clearly, Putin is currently worried about his security, otherwise he wouldn't have set up this new National Guard and done a massive security reshuffle. On the other hand, they have successfully inserted themselves as key players in Syria. They clearly see not just NATO, but the EU as a threat to themselves, and you could give Putin his best wishes for the next 5 years, it would be the destruction of NATO and probably the destruction of the EU. So they would then enter this game as external players. They're already encouraging a lot of the far right and far left, or what's left of it, inside the EU, and they would continue to do that game. And I think the future of NATO would be a really interesting question. I think the Brits would try to reassert their membership of NATO as a key part of our foreign policy to show that we're still international players. But would NATO itself begin to come into question if you have a more sort of vociferous foreign policy debate within the EU set off by Brexit? Then I think it's not clear that NATO would be strengthened by that. On the contrary, I think you'd have beginning of emergence of differences over what the future of NATO should be. And finally, I think China would begin to emerge more as a player within Europe itself. Again, I was struck on a recent visit to Prague. I was sort of caught unawares. I was on television, and they said to me, what do you think of President Xi Jinping's latest visit to Prague? And I actually didn't know he'd been there, so it was a tough one on live television. But he has been in Prague, as I later discovered, and the Chinese, as with Britain, are also looking to use their economic leverage, the attractions of their market, the attractions of possible Chinese infrastructure investment, to make themselves players economically within Europe, but also politically. And the controversy, it turned out, in the Czech Republic was whether the Czechs had gone too far, leant over too far to welcome Xi Jinping, etc., etc. And I think you will see more of that anyway because of China's new Silk Road strategy, which is to try to build up infrastructure right across Central Asia towards Europe. But again, if Europe is no longer a kind of effective actor, the ability for the Chinese to start looking for kind of allies within Europe will be enlarged.
Thank you very much, Gideon, who will be joining Ideas, by the way, soon, now as visiting senior fellow, so thank you very much. You managed not to mention the United States once, Steve. I think that was over to you.
I don't know, is this working? Yes, it is. Mick, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor to be here, actually. As usual, the problem with Gideon is I agree mostly with him, so I'll try not to repeat what he said. I must say, seen from the United States, this is a complete act of madness, this referendum. First to have it, and then to think of Britain leaving. It seems, except for Ted Cruz, who seems to think it's a great idea, but as everyone says about Ted Cruz, even his friends don't like him. And I suspect he's going to go down to a very bad defeat today in Indiana. But generally there is this extraordinary bipartisan, which is rare in America, agreement that something has gone mad with the Tory party. First majority since 92, it seems to be in the middle of destroying itself quite happily, and maybe it will come back together, but economically, strategically, in every way, Americans don't get it. I mean, you know, they think of it as misplaced nostalgia for a Britain that hasn't been around for many, many years, that the issue of sovereignty is exaggerated, blah, 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 blah. Now, we've had, you know, a pretty good relationship with Cameron. It's not been great, you know. I mean, after 8 years, Cameron still can't pronounce Barack Obama's first name properly, so that might give you an indication of how close they are. But the United States is actually quite worried about the implications of Brexit. They still haven't taken it, I think, on board as a real possibility, though I'm beginning to. But what was Obama's trip about? It was to visit Britain and Germany. The U.S. is two main allies in Europe who are both in difficulty. And the U.S. sees Brexit as, if it happens, a very important brick out of the wall of the post-Cold War order, which is already in trouble with Russia and Crimea and violations of the INF Treaty. And weakness at the United Nations and the Arab mess. And the last thing I think Washington wants is, you know, its only real dependable allies in the world, which is Europe, call it the European Union if you like, but Europe, continuing a decade-long self-involvement, stomach-staring inability to pick its head up and look to its responsibilities in the rest of the world, which would just get worse under Brexit. There's also, I think, a very strong feeling that with the migration crisis, Germany's influence is certainly hasn't disappeared in the EU, but suddenly Angela Merkel needs her partners in the EU for the first time, and they've reacted to her need with a little bit of schadenfreude and even some resentment, saying, well, tough, you know. The divisions pointed up from the migration crisis between North and South Europe, which were already severe with the Euro crisis, are now East and West. And this bothers the United States because it's just there's more instability and Putin is not going anywhere. They're worried about the sanctions against Russia. They're worried about lots of things. And there's also a conviction, which I think is also my own, that a Britain which in the first coalition government so vividly retreated from its responsibility in the world, if it pulls out of the EU, it will not make Britain a more decisive actor in the world. It will only, I think, underline and enhance the feeling in Britain of pulling away. Because if you're pulling away from a major multilateral institution that, in our view, enhances British influence and power, I can't see Britain swanning around the world as an independent actor, certainly not with any more verve than it's doing now. There's also, I keep saying it's not very polite, you know, but it's not like Britain, if it leaves Europe, you know, has a lover down the road waiting for it. I mean, Britain would be going to an empty hotel room. and it's a little sad, I think, because the United States is not there, you know, with a pot of tea waiting for Britain. It's just not true. And I think it's also true, everything Gideon said about the reaction of the EU itself. A lot of the uncertainty, of course, depends on the divorce settlement. And we don't know what the divorce settlement will be. You know, can it be done in 2 years? I doubt it. What happens in those 2 years? if Brexit wins, is Michael Gove actually serious about just being a WTO trader? I mean, in the world, is that the price of full control over borders? Who knows? That's the whole point. And as everyone has made clear, there's no incentive for the EU to make the divorce particularly amicable. I mean, it's meant, you know, as the messaging is now with the migrants, please stay home. The messaging, if Britain chooses to leave, will be, you know, regret it at your leisure, and we're going to make it so hard other people won't be tempted to do it. So for all these reasons, you know, I think the Americans really are, you know, really upset, quite honestly. And Obama was, you know, there was a debate among his people how coy to be on his visit here. Now, whether he overdid it or didn't, I mean, I can't say. But they simply decided, I think quite rightly, come in, make the message clear, make it as strong as possible, don't fiddle around. I mean, there shouldn't be any confusion in anyone's minds, I think, at this point, what the United States thinks about it. Okay.
Thanks very much, Steve. And Cherry, maybe you could tell us what China thinks about it.
Oh, I thought it was Tim's done. Okay. Oh, well, never mind. Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you so much for Mick's kind invitation. And, Suzanne, can you all hear me? Okay. And I'm so glad to join this quite distinguished panel. I must confess, I don't really know much about Brexit except China's view towards Brexit, so I'd like to share my thoughts today. And it has been so rare President Obama and President Xi Jinping agree on something, but somehow it's for the first time they actually agree with each other, as the China holding a very strong view, Brexit is a total madness. And I believe there are three major reasons China believes so. And firstly, obviously, what exactly China wants from the European Union is to gain the full market access, and the UK actually acting as the first entry point to get into the European Union. So if the UK withdrawn from the EU membership, and such a hope for China will be diminishing so much. And even certain senior Tory politician has been pointed out recently by saying Britain is the best partner for China in the West, a gateway to Europe, but if UK leave the European Union, and there was no such hope for them anymore. And as you can see recently, the UK was ranking among the number two most popular investment destination within European countries to China. And as soon as you open your eyes in the morning, you're embracing by products actually owned by the Chinese company nowadays. So if you're eating your breakfast, having Weetabix, that's owned by the Chinese now. And if you're drinking your water, by the way, that's owned by the Chinese Agua. And if you want to drive your car to work, unfortunately, MG Rover is also owned by the Chinese. And finally, if you're saying, okay, I don't drive, I take taxi, again, the black cab is owned by the Chinese, not even to mention the Heathrow Airport and Manchester Airport for those two. So with the whole ranging of investments, Chinese entrepreneurs has been set up in London or in the UK in general, and you could imagine once the UK will retreat from the EU and how much economic stakes and financial stakes those Chinese companies has been taken so far. And also from the point of view for the City of London, and as most of you who are working in the city, and you would know renminbi, first international trading spots is being set up in London. And as you can imagine, how much transaction fees has been taking place with all different renminbi transactions. I'm talking about in millions and billions, not just thousands in here. So once the UK retreat from the EU, and I'm sure Chinese investors will be looking for different investment platforms and different cities to invest and to put in their renminbi offshore trading points. So that's a key economic reason why Chinese believe the UK should stay within the EU. And secondly, which I agree with Gideon in here, regarding the China-EU relations, one of the major obstacles between China, between Beijing and Brussels is on the market economy status issue. Has been so many years, China has been the largest trading partner with the EU, but however, the EU still refused to recognize China being a market economy. For some good reason or bad reason, the UK has been the strongest supporter within Brussels, to granting China market economy status. And part of the reason is because the main majority industry for the UK is a service economy, not the manufacturing economy, which pose far less threats as countries like France or Italy does. And therefore, the UK government, such as both Labour and the Tory government, has been a very strong supporter for China on this case. And if UK withdraws from the EU, unfortunately, China will lose its biggest supporter in Brussels in that case. And the last reason, which I think probably is the most important reason, even though last year President Xi Jinping and David Cameron made very clearly they want to develop a comprehensive strategic partnership between China and the UK, but somehow I felt much discussion within the media, as well as within the policy world, it hasn't been really talking about much on strategic element of this bilateral partnership at all. Much has been focusing on trade and investments. So there has been so much both sides can be done. And part of the reason why China considering us being a comprehensive strategic partnership is because the UK's permanent member state as being one of the permanent five of the UN Security Council. And there's so much China and EU could collaborate together. And by doing so, China could learn how to advancing its own global influence. But however, it seems to be that's not happening at all. And if the UK withdrawn from the EU again, and China will just only drifting the UK away and just leaving UK as a trade partner. And one other thing I have to criticize or just saying something different from the Chinese government in here, by simply shopping around the world or shopping around the UK offering grand strategy projects or grand strategy or infrastructure projects, this will not gain any respect for both British government as well as the British public. China should learn how to gain respect by creating more skilled diplomatic efforts, more policy clarities, as well as more bureaucratic transparencies in here, and try to show Britain what kind of partnership does China want to develop with the UK. And on the very last reason, which I believe UK Brexit has been such a fear for President Xi Jinping, is on domestic level. And UK in China has always been seen as imperialist power, has been a colonized power, and the past humiliating memory of the European war has largely been existed in the mind of both British citizens as well as the Chinese elites. So by creating this golden era or so-called golden partnership between the UK, it seems to be a huge triumph for President Xi Jinping himself. And as you can see from the media, UK has offered the reddest of red carpet to the Chinese president, and obviously has been well covered by the Chinese media. And if UK decided to retreat from the European Union, and the triumph of President Xi has become like a disaster totally. So that's a very dangerous for him, as within the party, within the Chinese Communist Party, he has many enemies. And those enemies could possibly, using this kind of image problem, to turn in against him. And this could be completely disaster for him as well. So this is another very last reason why the Chinese are so much afraid of Brexit. So to conclude, perhaps Chinese could really learn a lesson in here by realize how much internal party politics has been externalized and how much danger it will do for that country. So that's something the Chinese Communist Party have to be learned over the long term. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cherry. And finally, over to Tim Oliver.
Thank you very much. Is this working? Yep. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to talk a little bit more about something that Steve mentioned, which is the divorce and the divorce process. I've put on your desk copy of an introduction for some of you. You might have this, the rest of you, unfortunately, I didn't print enough copies. An introduction to a series I've just started with the LSE's Brexit Vote blog, which is run by Rock, who's sat at the back there. This builds on some series I've run before. I've got a little network now of somebody in every other EU member state who can give me their country's perspective on Britain's renegotiation, what they think a Brexit might mean for them. And a few weeks ago, I emailed them all saying, look, you've all seen... given that you're following this, you've all seen what the opinion polls look like. Isn't it now time that I ask you to outline in just a few hundred words what you think your country's red lines might be in any exit negotiations with the UK? And we're slowly running these through the Brexit Vote blog. I did the introduction, and we've run two sets of views so far, and hopefully in the next few weeks we'll have all 27 other EU member states and the European Parliament, or at least a perspective from them all. This is, I admit, as I say in the introduction to this series, a very speculative exercise. Obviously, no government wants to openly talk about this, but nevertheless, we felt it was important to try and outline what different member states may set down as their red lines with the UK and with one another. Because as I'll explain as I go through this over my 5 minutes, this isn't just about dealing with the UK, this is about the rest of the EU dealing with one another in any exit negotiation. So the first thing to set out is, before we can speculate about what the different member states may take as their red lines, you need to speculate about what actual process by which the European Union would handle a British exit. Now, we have a withdrawal clause in Article 50 of the Treaty of European Union. This was set down or introduced to the treaties by John Kerr, the British diplomat, in part because he had Britain in mind. The two key things to take away from Article 50, as many of you might already be aware, is first of all, it sets a two-year time limit to negotiate an exit that is extendable via unanimous agreement. And secondly, it requires the agreement of all 27 member states and essentially the European Parliament over any exit deal. Now, some Eurosceptics, in the UK, are aware that this essentially gives the EU control of the process. It has control of the timing. It has to agree in terms of 27 plus the European Parliament over how to deal with this. So Britain is in a bit of a weakened position. And some Eurosceptics argue that, first of all, we can just ignore Article 50. We could go down some completely alternative route. Or secondly, you could neutralize the time limit by delaying the triggering of Article 50. So if David Cameron were to lose the referendum, then he doesn't have to trigger Article 50 in the next few days after June the 23rd. He could trigger it within 6 months, maybe a year. Well, first of all, I don't know if Eurosceptics themselves will be too keen to wait for Britain to actually put in a formal notification that it's going to withdraw. And secondly, I don't know why the rest of the European Union would willingly agree to any other series of exit negotiations that necessarily benefit Britain more than them. So I think it is settled that it's going to be the Article 50 route by which the UK leaves. In terms of negotiations, as I set out in this little article, it's not simply one set of negotiations with the UK. Back in, I think it was January or February, Open Europe ran a Brexit war game in which in the morning they wargamed out the renegotiation that was going on between Britain and the rest of the European Union over a renegotiated relationship. And then in the afternoon they wargamed out what an exit negotiation would look like. And they had Norman Lamont representing the UK. He presented a deal that was essentially the Canadian-European trade deal plus budgetary contributions and a few other things. And then the rest of the EU responded from around the table. And as one journalist described it, it became something of a lynch mob. The rest of the EU essentially threw the tables at Norman Lamont, saying, you know, what have you done? This is stupid. We're not going to do anything. And it became obviously a to-and-fro. Things calmed down as the afternoon progressed. But nevertheless, it became a to-and-fro between the UK and the EU. That's only one part of this, however, because as Article 50 makes clear, and as obviously any diplomatic realistic scenario would point to, the UK will not be in the room when the rest of the EU negotiates what its own position will be. So you will have a kind of an EU-UK in brackets negotiations rather than EU-UK, in which the rest of the European Union, which 27 member states, will essentially sit down and say, OK, what are we going to do here? What offer are we going to make to the UK? What are we going to put together that we can get through the European Parliament? And by the way, there's this European Court of Justice that's floating around, which, depending on what type of deal and which type of approach we take, could in some way become involved in this. And Britain, of course, will be floating around the outside, lobbying the different member states as it did over the renegotiation, but obviously it can't be in the room. And when people talk about the Eurozone caucusing against Britain, this is the kind of the mother of all caucuses within the EU. This is 27 member states and the European Parliament at the UK, essentially. What will it agree? Well, for my mind, you can break down how the rest of the European Union will approach this into what I call five I's. Which one will it prioritise? Which ones will be the most important? Will it be ideas? Ideas of European unity, European integration, of political cooperation that come first? Or will it be interests, the second I, business interests, such as German car manufacturers, Irish farmers, Dutch multinationals and so forth? Will it be institutions? The EU is limited in what it can do to the UK, both by its own rules and by international rules, so it can't raise tariffs in some ridiculous way because of WTO rules. Will it be international pressures, that events over Ukraine, events in the Middle East and so forth, pressure potentially from the United States over TTIP, that will drive the rest of the European Union to realise we need to do a good deal with Britain because it's important for our international standing? all it come down to individuals. How will Angela Merkel react to a British vote to leave the European Union? How will the rest of the European Council react when David Cameron walks back into the room a few days after the June the 23rd vote? Will they slow hand clap him as he walks back in? How will individual leaders react to this, especially given in France and in Germany, of course, there are actual domestic elections next year? Now, as anyone who's negotiated with the European Union will tell you, the EU can be a very stubborn actor because, of course, the deal it presents is a compromise in itself amongst 28 member states. And that's essentially what the UK could find itself facing. On top of that, and this is possibly the more important negotiation from a lot of member states' perspective, there won't be just EU negotiations about the UK, there will be EU negotiations about itself and how its internal balance of power will change. So you can call it, as I describe it in the piece, EU brackets EU. The British exit will obviously change. The most obvious changes will be in qualified majority voting, allocation of members of the European Parliament, budgetary contributions and so forth. But it's here that you will see some of the real most, the deepest fighting, given concerns about will a British exit enhance German power? Will it shift the balance of power in the European Union further east? Will it disadvantage smaller states, or will it embolden smaller states? Will it scare some of the more liberal, outward-looking member states? And, of course, you also have to consider that for some member states, Britain just isn't a factor for them in the European Union. I think The Economist asked the good question, why should Romania worry about economic links with the UK when its own economic links with the UK are small? It will be concerned about freedom of movement, so that will be one of the things it puts on the table. But at the same time, it will be thinking, how can we get this out of Germany? What, within a changed European balance of power, can we get out of this? What could we get from Germany? On top of that, you also have EU-Europe negotiations. The EU cannot simply negotiate a British deal whereby Britain becomes a member of EFTA or the European Economic Area without consulting with Norway and Switzerland. And then you've got all of EU business. While this is going on, routine business can continue. And as Gideon hinted at, Britain could become a troublemaker in this. Michael Gove has said that they could veto or adopt an empty chair crisis to try and bring EU business to a grinding halt. That is one of the concerns that you find elsewhere in the EU, and it's just a case of how do we work around the UK then and just making the rest of the EU continue to work. So it comes down in terms of the red lines, which we're slowly mapping out. For me, it's already obvious that the two big things will be, one, what economic cost is the rest of the EU prepared to bear in terms of a British exit? And secondly, it will come down especially to freedom of movement. Will the rest of the European Union demand that the UK essentially become a member of the European Economic Area, even if as part of a transitionary period of maybe 15 years, by which the UK leaves, but for 15 years it remains a member of the EEA and therefore maintains freedom of movement? I don't know how well that will go down here in the UK, and I've written about separately how I could easily see a situation in which Britain calls a referendum on the exit deal it's essentially presented with by the rest of the EU.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and thank you all the speakers. I suggest we just move very, very quickly into Q&A. If people could just put their hands up or indicate...